It also may be between, you know, some authority and somebody else. It also may be between a spiritual master and a disciple. But most cases, it ought to be just plain old friendship. And it seems to me it's part of what's meant by making friends with devotees as revealing one's mind in confidence and receiving confidential revelations. Yes.
What if a devotee confides to me, he's having a spiritual problem? Or maybe he doesn't even confide to me, you know, say he's not chanting his mantras, mm-hmm. tell his spiritual master. Is that wrong?
It depends on the case.
Because you feel,
sure.
His spiritual master, you know, can help him if he knows what's wrong. And so it depends.
Yeah, I think it depends on the particular case. You have to do something that's going to have a favorable outcome for the person involved. If that person has told you a confidence and on the grounds that you're not going to tell anybody, even the spiritual master, and then you go and violate that trust, you may be able to do so on the basis of some higher principle, but you have to understand that also you're going to pay a price for that, and is it worth the price to pay? That of making a promise you didn't keep. You know, so all these different factors have to be taken into account. But one should be very sensitive about this.
They may not have expressly said, don't tell anyone.
Well, then maybe it's a good thing you told. You know? But then also, you should either if you didn't tell, ask ahead of time, you should also go to that person afterwards. And if there's been some breach in the relationship because of it, you should then repair that relationship. You say, you may have thought that, you know, because I did this, that I broke your confidence. Fall at the feet, please forgive me. I only did this because I wanted to help you. If you've really been offended by this, I'm very, very sorry. You know, you have to repair that relationship. You can't say, oh, well, you know, I shouldn't. You know. So, Dominic, I want to get beyond page 1 here, too.
I just
wanted
to say, I remember that specific situation. One boy not so long ago, and what his friend did was persuade him to go himself and say,
that's always best.
Yeah, and then that really cemented the relationship not mm-hmm. only with the friend, but even stronger with the spiritual yeah. master.
That's always best. That's a good point. The first thing is, if you think this person ought to tell the spiritual master, then your first obligation is to try to counsel him to do so. That's quite true. Then if he doesn't do that, then you have to think again about what's the best thing for that person's well-being. Let's go on. We'll come back to all these topics, I think. So he's saying that if this personal relationship is there, in which there's trust on the one side and the ability to listen with intelligent sympathy on the other, he says good results are likely to follow. And then he discusses an article by a psychiatrist that basically says the same thing, who talks about the different techniques of hypnosis, of the orthodox Freudian thing where the patient lies on a couch and the therapist is instructed to show no emotional response and to be kind of cold and neutral. They all have their various doctrines. But he says, the essential fact about the situation is that Brown, the patient, is talking seriously and earnestly about vital issues to McConaughey, who's the doctor. So then Boyson says, so this is his reinforcement. Details of procedure are of vanishing importance. He means vanishingly small, so long as this relationship is there. And then he talks about various other techniques that are important, keeping good records and so on like that. Manadasi gets into this. So here's a certain amount of tact in dealing with human relations, which we may have or we may not have. But if we don't have, can certainly be learned. And so he said things here. From the skilled worker, I'm in the bottom page 241, the beginner may learn how important it is in questioning a patient or his relatives to establish a proper point of contact. He may note how such a worker begins by putting the informant at ease, how to make people relaxed and feel at ease, how he asks first questions of central importance and works from them back to questions regarding grandfather or grandmother, the alcoholic uncle, and how carefully he prepares for the way those questions on which the informant is likely to be sensitive. Now he goes on about the skilled counselor. He may learn to recognize the significance of things that are not said, something that's left out, and to take note of the sudden pause, of the embarrassed smile, of the averted eyes, of the shift in position, which to those who have eyes to see may speak as plainly as words. Now today there's plenty of books out on these topics. Body language, it's now called. The language of gesture, of eye expressions, which people intuitively have learned how to read for years. But you have to be sensitive to these kinds of things. He may also learn the importance of leaving the patient free to tell his own story in his own way and with only such questions and comments as are necessary to stimulate him and draw him out and guide him toward the most significant topics. And now here comes the clincher. Probably there is no more important lesson for the average minister or teacher than this art of listening. For not uncommonly, he likes to do the talking himself. So we say to somebody, I'm going to preach to him. We already know what's wrong. We got our agenda. We're going to say, you know, we see where this guy is off. He's going to come to us. We want to tell him what to do. But that's not the really important thing. The really important thing is the establishment of the proper relationship. And that proper relationship involves listening. And that's why, you know, in that book, The Art of Teaching by Burijan, in the course that Raja Bihari and others have been, The Art of Listening is exactly what. So you can read the chapter in that book, take the course, and learn just a few little techniques to do exactly what Boysen is describing here so long ago. Leaving the patient free to tell his own story in his own way. And what do? Questions and comments to stimulate him, draw him out, and guide him toward the more significant topics. Now, the first thing is, shut up and listen. It's very, very important. That's establishing the relationship. So, from the good psychiatrist, he, that is the religious worker, should learn the need of beginning with the other fellow, of listening without condemning, of trying to understand his language, particularly that symbolic language which is tended to be understood only by those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. So, anyway, this is the very important point. Yes? Do what? I believe so. I've seen this happen often enough when people come to a temple for the first time, and some devotee who's eager to preach, I notice the guest standing in the corner with a cornered look, and the guy is talking and preaching, and the guest is going... And because he's just going to down dump Krishna consciousness. and the guest is already suffering from information overload, and you're just keeping on down dumping and not looking to see, you know, what signals are coming back. And when it does come time to preach, it'll be much more effective if you know something about the person. What their interests are, what their concerns are, what their worries are, what their background is, where they're coming from. And so also, just for ordinary preaching, the first thing is not to be so eager to tell people the truth, but to actually listen. And it's, because that listening does two things. One, it establishes a relationship. If we just lay the foundation, maybe word, I won't get the time to preach. If you establish the relationship, they'll come back again and again. If you just do your down dump, that person may never show up again. So the first thing is establishing the relationship of friendship. And friendship means caring to hear about the other person. Now, we may know that they're in Maya, and that a lot of what they're going to tell us is going to be Maya. The other thing is when you're listening, you don't have to jump right away. As soon as the person says something wrong, you don't have to jump down their throat. You can let it go by. You'll get back to it later. You note it, and you know, put it on your list to deal with. This person has this conception. You don't necessarily have to. And so the establishing relationship, and then you'll know when the time's come for you to say something, you'll know the right point to begin. Just where to of all the things you could say to somebody in Krishna consciousness, you may know the thing that's going to strike that person the most. You may find they've had some friend that just died. You may end up finding they're in a crisis involving a vocation or career. You may find, you know, all so many different things. But you can speak to them. You ought to know whether you're talking to the inquisitive, the searcher of knowledge, the searcher after wealth, or the distressed, for example. All these things come from listening. So those are the two reasons that in ordinary preaching. And even more so when you're dealing with somebody who's already in our community but still needs to go further. Yeah?
You mentioned this to you personally, that for the benefit of the question, Srimad Bhaktivedanta Swami was telling us in South Africa that most people stay in ISKCON because of loving relationships, not so much because of the philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And if they, even, you know, that somebody cares about them, willing to listen to their problems and wants to help them, that may be more than just an intellectual understanding of the philosophy.
Yeah, so we shouldn't make loving relationships too hard to find. I know for myself I practically stayed in spite of the devotees and because of the philosophy, but I was somewhat of an unusual person. But the devotees were so, I mean, that's the way they were. When, you know, they had when I first came to the temple, they had a very hostile relation. In some temples at that time, there was a policy for the devotees to gather at the Sunday feast right in front of the altar so the deities wouldn't have to look at karmis.
Yeah.
That was the philosophy, yeah. They were really in the mood of chastisement. Every moment, you know. The first time I went to a Sunday feast with a friend of mine, we had a nice Sunday feast. My friend did what he usually does after a meal, you know. He reached in his pocket and pulled out a cigarette and started to have a smoke, you know. And the devotee said, oh, I'm sorry, we don't smoke here. He said, how can you take a cigarette like that after eating prasadam? Don't you know that's a disgrace? You know, blah, 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 you know. Jumped down his throat, and of course the fellow never came back again. Well, the classic one, this lady said to me, I was walked outside of the temple and it was a beautiful sunset happening. And she was standing next to me and I said, oh, what a beautiful sunset. And she says, it is not beautiful. It's horrible. And if you think it's beautiful, you'll just have to take birth again and again in the material world to enjoy it. Yeah, you know, because I saw some truth in what she was saying, I put up with it. But definitely, you know, then you never want to open my mouth again, you know. I mean, she could have said, yes, it is beautiful, and think of how much more beautiful is that from which it comes. Or yes, and according to Bhagavatam, the dawn and the sunset are the dress that Krishna wears. You know, I mean, there's so many ways you could have, you know, taken one's attention away from Maya to the absolute truth. This is called, you know what this is called in English? It's called tact. T-A-C-T. Anyway, we've often been a very tactless lot, you know, because we got the truth and we're going to, you know,
let them have it,
you know, one way or the other, you know. You know, a giant suppository friend. Yeah.
But it's also for people who are already in temples and already in congregations. It gave the example of some devotee is sick and Giselle for a moment doing well. Oh, it's just your body, you're not the body, it's Krishna's mercy.
Oh, yeah, sure, I know that.
And instead you just go and say, well, is there anything you kind of do, I can do for you? You need some medicine, you need some special prasad.
Yeah, it used to be that way in Ajahn too. To be sick was to be in Maya. It was simultaneously one and the same thing. Yeah. So people have to come and people have to stay. Now, if we get back to this, so the art of listening, I mean, it's a good thing everywhere. And bringing people to Krishna consciousness and in dealing with a congregation, people who are regularly coming, and in dealing with other devotees, because that forms that relationship that keeps people. And also we become much more effective. Then he talks about various methods that the church has employed. He talks about faith healing, which operates by suggestion, and then hypnosis. Then he talks about psychoanalysis, Freud and Jung. But he then concludes on 254. This brief resume of the chief psychotherapeutic techniques will suffice to indicate 245, I'm sorry. I switched those last two numbers. That common to them all is the primary importance of the relationship between the physician and patient. The techniques and methods of procedure are of vanishing importance compared with the qualities of heart and mind. The genuine interest in the patient and his problems, together with the balanced judgment and insight and tact, there's that word, necessary to win the patient's confidence and establish the rapport, that is the mental connection, which is the sine qua non. Sine qua non is Latin for that without which not. Without which not, yeah, that, no, without, the necessary thing, the sine qua non, the necessary quality of all effective psychotherapeutic work. With these qualities, the techniques will take care of themselves. Right? So again, let's look at what he says. Qualities of heart and mind. He mentions genuine interest in the patient and his problems. I guess professionals learn how to fake that genuine interest. But as devotees, a genuine interest should follow as a result not of some material attraction or interest in a person, but just out of a sense of compassion for people. By genuine interest is meant that one should care about others. Prabhupada mentions that the quality of a Vaishnava, well, Bhagavatam mentions, Prabhupada's lectured on it several times, is paraduka duki. He may have no problems of his own, or suffering of his own, but suffers when he sees the suffering of other people. So So really, the calling of a Vaishnava is that a Vaishnava is one who lives his or her life for the sake of other people. Now that can be quite a strain, and we need social reinformation, social support and reinforcement for that also, because it can be quite exhausting. If you are available for other people, giving sympathy and support, it sometimes is amazing how much need people have of it, and it can get quite draining. And one has to also be able to go to others for some kind of spiritual restoration if you feel a little exhausted by this. But so genuine interest in others and their problems is something that should be in our hearts. At least they should have the genuine interest in becoming genuinely interested, if nothing else, so that we can progress in that way.
Prabhupada, he said that compassion is a quality of the mind of goodness. So if somebody doesn't feel compassionate, he said that we become more purified. We become more compassionate.
It also means, in a lot of respects, having one's own problems under some kind of effectual dealing. If you're overwhelmed by your own problems, then it's really hard to look at other people's problems. You know, if you're sick yourself, you know, and other people are sick, it's really hard to get interested, you know. I'm sick. It takes a real saint who's, like, really sick and ignores their own, like I'm talking about a physical illness, and still takes care of other people, you know. Yeah.
And then in here, the teacher said that is to get people to open up and talk by telling the Buddhists, ask people questions that can be answered in one of two ways, but not no. Don't just get negative energy generated. Don't ask them something and say no. Just ask them questions they can answer in two ways. Like, do you read books to learn things, or just to enjoy reading? You have to shoot them with the answer, and begin to talk, you know. What they're interested in.
But you don't say, do you like books? Because they can say no. But you say, do you read books to learn things or to be entertained?
You're from here out of town, you have a student, or do you work?
And then they say something. That's an interesting point. So, Dominic?
Of course, we're talking about counseling, so basically we're talking about an unequal relationship. In other words, the counselor is being a friend to the person, but actually, friendship as we know it in Krishna consciousness, you may reveal your mind to that friend, and they may hear properly and help you, but then they may turn around and reveal back. In other words, the more equal relationship, the friendship. And it would seem that establishing the relationship that both of you make advance, then eventually that revealing mind and confidence won't necessarily be, sharing our problems, but actually sharing spiritual realization.
Yeah, of course. Here we're talking of particularly dealing with people with problems. It's true that if you have friends, that you may take the relationship may be unequal in this particular circumstance, but sometimes you take turns. One take being the doctor and the patient, so to speak, and you may switch.
The downside of that I've experienced is that you rely on some heavy issue. And they go, oh, God, they've got the same thing going on. They come and spit it right back out. And then the type of dialogue with a figure in authority, the representative of God, the voice of Sita, can't transpire. Because then that's why he needs to point that and grow the frequent issues to a family counselor. Otherwise, it just churns up the ocean in their own heart.
Sure. But there are also people who, precisely because somebody is a representative of God, they won't go to. Boysen talks about this in the second article. The disadvantage of being the representative of God. those are precisely the people that people will avoid you for. Some people will go to you for that reason, and some people will avoid you for that reason. So for those people that are avoiding, then the other, the friend, becomes a kind of special fallback position.
Say Arjuna goes to Krishna originally because he's dead.
But then it becomes
then
unequal.
Becomes important, then he drops that.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, I was just there was an Anglican priest. Actually, I don't know if it was a bishop. It was a priest who started Lifeline, which is the people who were contemplating suicide or had other highly emotional problems could phone in and speak with someone. And he made it he said, don't talk about religion, especially right off the bat, because it may just make totally, some people may feel so depressed, and that may even be a source of their depression.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, he was an Anglican priest. He also believed in reincarnation. He said that it was the only way there could be justice.
Mm-hmm.
But he tells the counselors, don't talk to them about religion.
That
may make them more depressed, he said.
Mm-hmm. This goes in with the second part, balance, judgment, insight, and tact, necessary to win the patient's confidence and establish the rapport. Now you can say, well, how do I get balance, judgment, insight, and tact? Well, there's no easy, what he's saying here, there's no easy formula for that. You just have to be, it requires experience, growth, depth, and so many things are there. But one should understand what at least we're aiming at in this relationship. Now, if we go on in this essay and we look at page 247, he talks about training and the medical person and all those other things, different issues. But whether is a It says the point, whether a person is a physician or a clergyman or other title, when it comes to intelligent dealing with emotional or spiritual difficulties of his fellows, says the first essential is that the beam should have been removed from his own eyes. You know what he means by the beam?
A log of wood,
yeah, because that's from the Bible. What Jesus talks about, in fact, punctiliousness and fault-finding. Why do you look for the mote, the tiny spot in another person's eyes when there's a big log in your own? You know, precisely that. He should, first of all, have found solutions for his own difficulties, which are socially acceptable, in order that his own biases and protective devices may not make him a blind leader of the blind. He must, in other words, have attained to some measure of discipline and integrity and fineness of character. He wants to say this is true of anybody who's in this relationship. Because actually what happens is if one is really absorbed in one's own problems and hasn't solved them, then you really have a hard time seeing other people clearly. And usually you see other people are just other versions of yourself a lot of times. So this is very important. And then he gives other things. And what he was saying in the concluding part of the chapter is he goes and contrasts the experience of the clergyman who has something essential on the one side. That is to say, understanding the best and noblest in the experience of his race, that is God and those kinds of things. And what the physician has, not the ideal, but at least dealing with reality of real people and real need and real pain. So he says, now I have no brief for either profession. He's not making the case like a lawyer for either one. I have had almost as much difficulty with the one as with the other, physicians and clergymen alike. I can only say that from the standpoint of the mentally ill on whose behalf I speak, I scarcely know which is worse, to have to depend upon a clergyman who has never come to close grips with the realities of human nature, and got his head in the clouds, knows the philosophy, but just can't relate to human beings. He'll just lay down all the time the correct doctrine, but can't tell you how to apply it to your life, you know. Or to be at the mercy of a physician who has no understanding of the spiritual needs and aspirations of the noble potentialers of mankind. Well, that's see, either one is bad news. We may find somebody who may be really adroit and really good counselor and can sympathize and all this other stuff, but can't actually guide us correctly on the path of Krishna consciousness. We've had a few of those in our movement also. So both things really have to eat. So boys and wants, and we should also try to exemplify both sides of these things. This is called, you know, in one sense you could call it jnana and vijnana. Remember the qualities of a brahmana? Jnana, vijnana, astikyam. In that context, you can say that
big one.
Okay. What verse is that? Does anyone know Bhagavad Gita? Yeah, yeah. 1842. And list the characteristics of a brahmana. And your brahmana is your counselor, you know, the ideal counselor who's in the mode of goodness, who's supposedly spiritual man, who's socially detached, who doesn't have personal issues involved in everything. So jnana in this context really means that you know the books, you know the scriptures, you know the Siddhanta. Right? And vijnana means that you know how to apply it correctly. That's the meaning, you knowledge and wisdom. It's usually translated as knowledge. Here I think Prabhupada translates it as knowledge and wisdom. But wisdom means the ability to take what you know of spiritual truth, jnana, and apply it to the ongoing realities of life. So what Boysen is saying is that, you know, right now, he's got clergymen with jnana and physicians with vijnana, but they don't often see the two together. But they're there in the qualities of a brahmana, jnana, vijnana, astikya.
Is it a different context than I said in the chapter?
Yes,
a different context. Yeah. Phenomenal.
Phenomenal. Yeah. Numinous. Prabhupada had a combination of those two words. This is the original. Okay, so that's that particular chapter, and we'll continue and try to deepen these topics tomorrow. We'll discuss the next chapter. Prabhupada. We're discussing. Therapeutic kinds of things. How to help other people. So we looked at last time, yesterday, the foundations of spiritual healing. Any more questions about that particular chapter? That's still lingering. So now we have a big chunk of this chapter called the distinctive task of the minister of religion. Would you have a big chunk of that chapter? I stopped where he started talking about the distinctive task in the ministry of religion in dealing with people who have problems with their sexual drive. Because then he goes, spends pages and pages and pages to argue for what we already accept anyway. Namely that easy solutions are not acceptable. So he talks about, what he's talking about here is the traditional role of the minister of religion, and he talks about his characteristic activities. which makes certain changes about, talks about what we do, conducts public worship, preaches, administers the sacraments, does RT, distributes prasadam, you could say, those kind of things. Widely as the various church bodies differ among themselves, all of them have solemn assemblies, certain symbolic acts for birth, death, marriages, the routine rituals, Prabhupada calls. And anyway, he sums up by saying, in any case, it is clear, I'm reading at the top of the page 265, he says, in any case, it is clear that the priest or minister of religion in his vocational capacity has always been looked upon as the representative of the superpersonal. He is the servant or agent of God. So he stands for God. And he points out here, he says, in many cases that will be a source of power, but in other cases it will set limits to what he can do. He'll get into that later on. So what he does in this chapter is, first of all, he talks about what he does, particularly in a hospital dealing with those who are acutely ill. And then he turns to deal with the ordinary pastor and applies the same principles. So because he applies the same principles, it's worthwhile looking at what he says that he does with those who are acutely ill, because he thinks it's really the same thing, just operating in different circumstances. So first he notices that in a mental hospital, I recognize my obligation to all the types of sufferers congregated here. So he doesn't see that he's just going to deal with one type, but he says those who are aged and he's to give comfort to the aged and hope to those whose remaining days are to be spent within the confines of the institute, give courage and hope to the physically ill, and so on. He says that there's a lot of people he can't do much for, but whatever he can do to help anybody on any platform, he feels he has an obligation to do something. But then he says, in the case of those who are grappling desperately with the issues of spiritual life and death, those in whom the better self is struggling for control and survival in the face of unacceptable tendencies which threaten to engulf it, I feel I have a task that is distinctly my own. And then he kind of rehearses the things we studied in the first part of this class about his analysis of people who are undergoing this kind of spiritual crisis. And then he says, at the end of the paragraph, my first task is therefore to discover those persons in whom the better self is really struggling to get possession, and in whom the constructive forces have really a chance to win out. So he looks for the people actually to put his really real time and effort into, the people he can actually help. If there are some people, he says, like in the middle part of the paragraph, he says, there's some people that he can do very little for. It would take many, many hours of skillful work to bring about modification in their attitudes, and with crying need on every side, the time can be used to better advantage.
What else?
I've just gone back up to the upper part of the paragraph. So he actually discriminates. Those people that he really feels he can't help do much for, he lets go. It's just like when we preach to people. I remember once when we should also use our energies productively. When the Radha Damodar bus party, when it first got started, it came to Philadelphia, and they had a system where they'd have a bhajan band playing, and they were serving out prasadam, and kids at a college campus would take prasadam and listen to this bhajan band. And then Tomal Krishna Goswami would go around to people and he'd say, how do you like the food? How do you like the music? And the people that said, oh, it's really great, I love it, he'd keep on talking to them. Those people who were negative or indifferent, he just went on. He said, why should I waste my time? They got some prasadam, they heard the chanting, and I just let them go. So you would find those people that were interested and attracted, and those the people you would preach to. So generally that's a principle we can always apply. Just like we're not supposed to preach the glories of the holy name to those who are faithless, if somebody is hostile. So the same way, he looks for really those people that he thinks that he can really, there's something there that he can help, and he deals with those. And then he judges how he can help, not on the basis of how severely disturbed they are, but on the basis of the reaction pattern. Remember in that chart, reaction pattern referred to specifically whether they were, I believe, frank or confused or oblivious. Is that right? Is that what he called reaction? Yeah. Frank or concealed. That's the degree of awareness. Frank or concealed or withdrawn. So those people that he looked like had not a lot of concealment were the ones he could help the most. Yeah.
And it seems that sometimes the reorganization may be that there's a breaking down of primary loyalties and then there's better selves, like converges. Mm-hmm. Sometimes men already, they don't really have this higher ideal.
No, that's not what he's saying. I don't think he's saying that the primary loyalties break down, but that what breaks down is the organization of a personality that's been avoiding the primary loyalties. Now, when he says a better self, he means where the separation between yourself and what you think your primary loyalties, that's what breaks down. The concealment mechanisms and things like that.
But the ultimate loyalties, they can sometimes enter in a situation of reorganization.
Yeah, they do, but they're always. But when he says reorganization, it's always
how it's dealt with.
Huh?
How the gap.
Yeah. Right. So the it's not that the primary loyalties go away. It's just that his estrangement from them has to be healed. Or feeling of alienation or separate isolation. Yeah. He says here, what is needed, I'm at the middle of 267, is to give the recuperative forces a chance in people undergoing acute things. In other words, he thinks that already they're involved in, this is like any good doctor, I don't heal, but I just like help nature heal. So he thinks that there are natural recuperative forces at work. And he gives them a chance and he says, restoring the shaken self-confidence and helping the patient to a constructive interpretation of his experience. So this is also a very good general principle when helping people. Somebody who's been suffering defeats in his attempts to advance spiritually, sometimes their self-confidence is shaken.